This is us learning in public, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We were at Vancouver Public Library. Yes. There are glass doors. Yes. We were literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
So last episode we spoke, we just started to get into what's happening in Wet'suwet'en. And I remember when we recorded the episode, both of us were really nervous. And I was really happy that you took the baton. You're like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And you did such a beautiful job leading that episode. So like, I want to thank you for that. But then I also have a bone to pick with you because basically after that episode, it just felt like, how do you follow an episode like that? You know, like I was telling you. You'd ask me like, oh, what are you going to talk about for the next episode? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, how do you follow that? Everything felt kind of like frivolous and not like weighty or important enough. Everything seemed to like pale in comparison.
Yeah.
To our conversation on how, what work we need to do as non-Indigenous folks in solidarity with land defenders and folks fighting for Indigenous sovereignty, mm-hmm. specifically with respect to Wet'suwet'en. And
I think it's Wet'suwet'en or Wet'suwet'en.
Wet'suwet'en. Thank you for that.
Yes.
So anyways, off the heels of that, thinking I had no value to add to this conversation, I thought, why not have a conversation today about what it is to be a settler? And like, let's talk about that in relation to our own experiences as two non-white folks. Oftentimes when we have conversations, sometimes we just don't have, we all think we're speaking the same language and we all say these like certain words. And I always am curious whether we all know what we're saying when we say the word settler, for example. And I really wanted to get specific about it in the context of our experiences because we center brown and black experiences specifically. And so one of the things that I don't want us to do is to be talking to, like, I know we have white listeners and like, thanks for being here, but this is like, you know, it's really for black folks, other folks of color. And we really, like last episode, I think you did a great job and we tried to do our best at just highlighting and showcasing the importance of what's happening in Wet'suwet'en. So
yeah. And like, I tried, but it's yeah. We really were scratching the surface. And I hope, because if I'm doing my work, I hope, you know, in 6 months and in a year, I'll look back and think it was kind of embarrassing.
Really?
That is my hope. Because
you want to like grow?
I want to always grow. Exactly. Right. And okay. I know that, again, like, obviously I've been anti-colonialism. I've had an understanding of Canada as a settler colonial state for a long time. Yeah. But I think... I'm diving deeper into the work now in a way that I haven't before. So I have a lot to learn in front of me. And so, I don't know. I just like to say that because I don't like to be like, yeah, I did a great job of talking about, you know, being a settler, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yes. And I know both of us want to continue to have these conversations. And so with you saying
we
that.
We want to go deeper.
Totally. So with you saying that, that also gives me room to knock a little perfectionist devil off of my shoulder because so much of what we're trying to do is cover, we're always trying to like cover all of our bases and make sure that we're like packing so much information into like a 30-40 minute episode.
Yeah, and doing justice to the things we
care about. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But in actuality, our intentional all the time is to like have these conversations and then continue to have them over time as things change for us to revisit some of these topics. So that's the intention.
Learning in public.
Oh, we really
it's
are.
It's in our
honey.
Intro.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. It should have played by now. So if you heard that, we knew that. Lala knew that. So in this episode, I just want to take a step back and talk about what we mean by settler. You know, it's a term that a lot of us are used to using who are like in social justice circles, I think, and anti-oppressive circles. But sometimes I think it's helpful for us to just double back and revisit how the term that is usually applied to a white person. Mm. And it's like, it's more complicated than mm-hmm. that.
Or like somebody who wasn't born here. Like there's some people who think, well, I was born here. My parents were born here. Like, my grandparents were born here. So I can't be a settler. And it's like, okay, but that's not actually what that means in this context.
I think there's a lot of different understandings of the word settler. And the reason that I wanted for us to have this conversation is I think that it can be helpful in our own sort of personal healing and liberation work that we have to do in conjunction with taking actions in solidarity with what's happening in Wet'suwet'en and Indigenous land defenders, their work in general, because the work of learning where we come from and all of, you know, our histories and our own legacies is tied to what's happening here, even if we don't understand it. And I'm still trying to understand it and learn about it. I mean, I was born here, and if I wasn't in the circles that I am and I wasn't doing this podcast with you, didn't have the education that I have and all that stuff, I wouldn't understand what the word settler really meant. So, and so much of Indigenous solidarity as settlers has to come from a place of acknowledging the land we're on. But for a lot of us, we actually don't have that much understanding if we're, you know, several generations removed from our quote unquote like home countries and stuff like that. And even if that's the case, I still think it's important to look back at, okay, if I know that I'm like Scottish, for example, if I know that I have this other ancestry that I don't know too much about, like what is the legacy of colonization or colonialism? So yeah, anyways, that's what I wanted to touch on. My family is from Kenya. My parents are both from Kenya. Your dad, Premila, is from
India.
India. Yeah. Malayali?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, I was like looking some stuff up and I was like, oh, like, Kerala? There's like a certain region.
Yeah.
So Kerala. Yeah. Sorry?
Kerala.
Okay. Yes. See? Learning. So yeah, I first want to start talking a little bit about what is settler colonialism? Because there's actually like lots of different types of colonialism, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think my understanding of settler colonialism is sort of what's happened in Canada, New Zealand, Australia. And so I went on the
South Africa.
Yeah. I went on the interwebs and there's this article from historians.org, and it was written a few years ago, but I think some of the context is really important. It's an article called A Typology of Colonialism by Nancy Shoemaker. And she offers different sort of examples of different types of colonialism. So I just want to list them here. I won't go too far into that, but I think it's just helpful to know what we're talking about. So settler colonialism, like I said, so it's like large numbers of settlers, quote unquote, claim land and become the majority, employing the logic of elimination. So it's like taking over, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Planter colonialism. So colonizers institute mass production of a single crop, such as sugar, coffee, cotton, or rubber. And then though a minority members of the ruling class might begin to belong to an empire that enables their political, legal, and administrative control. So their labor demands maybe cannot be satisfied by the native population, so they import African slaves or indentured laborers to get the work done. Then there's this thing called extractive colonialism. Mm-hmm. All the colonizers want is raw material found in a particular locale. So like sandalwood is an example, or a beaver for buffalo hides. And so this is like taking resources from a place and usually bringing them to your own sort of like local area.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's trade colonialism, transport colonialism, all this stuff. So, and then there's one called Not in My Backyard Colonialism, which is another spinoff. And I think they mentioned France and Algeria being one of the first sites of Not in My Backyard Colonialism, which basically is like colonizers sometimes want an empty place far away as wasteland for depositing convicts. Oh, so this is like about Australia. This is about like literally putting people that they don't want in a place, okay, and saying like, get out of here. I don't want to see you at all. So anyways, there's a lot of different types of colonialism. And one of the things that maybe kind of want to explore that is if you look at a map, I saw this map today of like all the different countries in the world that were affected. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Affected by... you'd like read the same like Instagram stuff.
Yes.
all the countries today that have been affected by European colonization, and there's like different colors, some of which that are like it's Europe, and then there's other countries that are like fully colonized by Europe. And basically out of all the countries in the world, all the states that are deemed as like nation states, only one region was not affected, or quote unquote affected, by European colonialism. Mm-hmm. Which I found like baffling and a little bit just disturbing. Mm-hmm. And so much of my own experience, I think, when I was a kid was knowing that I came from another place. So I'm curious for you, were you told or shown or provided with stories of what your home country was? Like if your dad ever did that to you?
No, not really. I didn't really spend that much time with my dad growing up. And he was more, at that time, more reluctant to talk about India. Like he talks more about his culture and his family and stuff now when you're around him. Mm-hmm. But at the time you like, we would like ask questions and it was so difficult. Like I felt like he was quite closed about it at the time. Yeah. So yeah, didn't really get very much of anything.
And I know we've talked in previous episodes and just in our own conversations about how being raised by your white family, by your mom, who's a white woman, and feeling different and feeling othered, especially growing up in like rural BC, how much did you understand or even like know of like what India meant to you or your family if your dad wasn't the one to impart that information on? And like, was there a time when you were more curious as a child?
I was always curious. Yeah. And we definitely always like, we always knew we were Indian and that one of my sisters and I, for sure, I'd have to ask the other one, but we were always curious and like yearning for that, but we just didn't really have access to it. It wasn't, you know, the internet wasn't what it is now.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were just in such like a white area. So yeah, we just didn't even know where to look, but we always like wanted it and very strongly identified with it, but like didn't know how to, you know, didn't know how to be a part of it.
Yeah. Or even attract it, especially if you don't have other like representation of other Indian people around you, if you're like one of the few in where you're growing up. Whereas for me, I guess what I was trying to get at was like, we had such different upbringings.
Yeah.
And so much of mine was like being aware that I was from a different place, but feeling like I was from here. And then also really wanting to do all that I could to, I guess, like show people or show the world, maybe even show myself that I belonged.
Yeah.
While feeling like, so there's something different about me. People always make me feel different or I look different.
Totally. There's always like the where are you from kind of thing. Like, I don't remember if it was said in those words at that time, but there was definitely always that feeling of you're different, you don't belong here.
And did you ever feel like you needed to prove to people where you're from, or like in feeling othered, did you feel like people understood like no, she's really from here? Or did you feel like because of the color of your skin and the like, I guess, small population of other people who looked like you, that you had to prove that, or felt like you needed to prove that you belonged? Or did you feel like, oh, this is an environment where I feel like I belong?
Yeah. I felt like I needed to prove I belonged. And then I think especially like, I don't know, I was born in Edmonton and went through grade one there and then moved to Trail. So I my dad always lived in cities, so like I knew that cities were a thing. I'd experienced them. And I always really hated living in that small town because of, you know, that environment of being so different and othered and all that. So I think I didn't feel it as much then because I wanted to like leave and not be a part of that place as much. Although I think I wished I felt like I belonged with, you know, social groups and stuff. But I think more as a young adult, like late teens, early 20s, like after I moved here, I think I definitely had more of that sort of, you know, there's a stubbornness too. Like when people be like, where are you from? I'd be like, here. Well, no, where are your parents from? And I would just be like, here. And like would refuse to tell them anything else. And sort of, you know, the claims of like, well, my grandfather was, you know, in the Navy here. You know, you're trying to sort like, of like, yeah, I'm Canadian. Like I'm one of, you know, I belong here.
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that's one of the things that I wanted us to talk about is like, in our quest for trying to stick it to the white man that we belong somewhere, because if in your experience all you're being told is that you don't belong, then you're going to fight so much harder to show people and to prove and to wear and own that you do, with like, because people will ask me like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, born at St. Paul's Hospital. Mm-hmm. Like that's my initial response, to be like, don't try it with me. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious of like, when we're fighting so hard and going so hard in the paint for that, like, one, I'm curious what your thoughts are. Like, how much are we, how much are our ancestors like turning in their graves being like, yeah. you are not from here? Like, how much are we disavowing our ancestry and an ancestry and like a legacy of people who fought colonialism themselves in their own homelands? I guess I'm just, I'm curious what your initial thoughts are. Like, do you, have you ever experienced like in the moment of saying like, I'm from here, like a sense of like, oh, should I really be like fighting this? And I understand if you would say no, because like sometimes you're just like, get this white person off me.
No, I don't think I have, because yeah, I think this is where our different upbringings come up.
Yeah.
Like, again, I didn't spend that much time with my dad growing up. I've never been to India.
Yeah.
I just don't, I don't know very much. I've never had an Indian community that has like claimed me that I've been a part of.
Yeah.
So I almost would feel the opposite. Like, I feel like if, when I try to claim that, I more feel like, I feel more of an, more like an imposter or like I might not be accepted by those people.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like the next thing you're going to go to is the thing of how that's been problematized for me.
Yeah, tell me.
That now it's like, well, who am I to claim
right.
this place as mine?
Here.
Because I'm a settler. This yeah. isn't my land.
Right.
Everything that I have here is stolen mm-hmm. and was stolen by my, you know, my ancestors, these same people that I could invoke to like get the white supremacist away from me, be like, oh, really? My white grandfather right. would be turning in his grave, like having, you know, been in the Navy and right. like worked here all his life. He would be turning in his grave to know that you're telling me that I'm not a real Canadian.
Right.
And that's probably true, but.
But like for a bad
but
reason.
What is,
like
for, like, but what is a real Canadian? It's right. a, you know, it's a settler. It's somebody who is part of this system of genocide,
mm-hmm.
who is actively still now
mm-hmm.
stealing land. And because of the special privileges that I still enjoy to be Canadian, continue to keep people off of the land that is theirs, that would allow them to be who they are, flourish in their culture, in their communities, like have enough to provide for themselves, you know, instead mm-hmm. of being forced off their land and into poverty by Canadian genocide, Canadian colonialism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you're saying makes a lot of sense. Like, I, obviously different upbringings.
Yes.
It's so interesting because there are certain things I write them down and I'm like, we're going to totally vibe on the same thing. And then I'm like, no, we're not.
Yeah.
Like, we
yeah.
have such different experiences growing up, even regions and like where and towns and cities and family and who raises you and stuff like that. Because for me, I could never like call on and be like, my ancestor did this, this, this to like get somebody to,
yeah.
to buy or believe that I'm from this place. All I could do was talk the way, like speak the way that I do and sort of like evoke my like education or like what I've seen or what I've done or where I've worked, like things like my resume almost, like. And to your point, I think it's like giving somebody a laundry list of like, these are all the things that make me really belong. And on the flip side of that laundry list, it's like on the back of who, on like to whose detriment or
mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of us, especially like second generation Canadians, and I can't speak for you, I guess I can, I don't know, but maybe I'll just say some stuff and you let me know how it feels for you. But I think for a lot of second generation Canadians whose parents migrate to Canada and work so hard to sort of like make their family get their kids to a place where they never could be. There's a lot of, there's like this badge of honor that you wear of like making it, of like getting out of the state that your parents were in when they first got here, of like accomplishing all this stuff that I think for a lot of us, and I'm speaking specifically of like second generation Black folks, folks of color, including both of those as like separate and distinct groups, there's a lot of us that do that to the death of us, like claim and get excited and like are proud of it to the death of us, without much critical understanding of who's displaced because we get to like be
yes.
like survive, like not just survive but like thrive,
yeah,
you know. And when I was thinking about this episode, I was also researching because I've seen some interesting comments online of folks making the distinction between settlers and who's not a settler, because I think when we put people in one big, like, sort of, like, pot and we say, mm-hmm. this is what you are, it can be helpful but can also be an erasure.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that I've come across that I'm curious what your thoughts are and what you've understood are the different kinds of ways that people have come to Turtle Island against their will because of forces of colonization and colonialism in their own home countries that make them a different, like, settler might not be the best word for to describe those people. So one of the terms which I found really interesting is for Black folks who are descendants of enslaved people. There's this really awesome article on Ricochet. Anthony Morgan, he calls Black folks who are descendants of slaves as forcibly displanted Africans, which I found interesting. Like, he just wanted to give language to, like, what is our relationship to place, mm-hmm. and how are we here? And I think I love that. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that was a term. I didn't know people were having those kinds of conversations. But I think it's really helpful for us to think, because it doesn't necessarily absolve us if we're considering ourselves like forcibly displanted Africans. It doesn't absolve us from how the work that we need to do, because we're not like a settler and settlers are like the worst kind. It's like, well, we're still like,
yeah, I think that there's people, the forcibly displanted people, refugees, yeah. of, you know, various races, I've heard, as, you know, not being settlers. There's probably, like, from that definition you just gave, there's probably some gray area of people who maybe weren't refugees, mm-hmm. but because of poverty that maybe was caused by colonialism in their home countries, that's part of their migration story. So maybe that would be,
yeah,
they might not be considered settlers in the same way. My father does not fit into that category. He came from a privileged family in India and came here for grad school.
Gotcha.
So that still, yeah, wouldn't change that. But there's probably a lot of people who do fall into that. And then I think, I don't remember who, because I've been reading a lot of, like, different sources lately, and I can't remember who said this, but I think I saw something along the lines of, yes, a lot of these people, you know, are not maybe settlers, but you can sort of become settlers if you buy into the settler colonial project.
I'm so glad you said that, because the next thing that I want to talk about is the model minority myth.
Okay.
So, and it's kind of what I was, like, chatting about earlier, where it's like, we take on and we wear this badge of honor, and I understand why we do the things that we do. It's not like there's no sense made to it. It's like, well, if your mom tells you day in and day out how she came to this country with $5 in her pocket to come give you a new life, and you had this new life here, and it's, you know, it's like, you owe it to mom. Like, you need to, yeah. you need to make, not just make ends meet, but you need to, like, survive and thrive and accomplish and do and send money back home and, like, representation. And that becomes a thing that we're all so fixated on. And again, speaking specifically for folks of color who are non-Indigenous. But I think on the flip side, we can also buy really hard into this, like, model minority myth where we're like, if I, you know, do blackness, for example, for myself, if I do blackness in this type of way, I'm palatable, I'm acceptable, I'm checking all the boxes, I'm doing the right things, I'm saying the right things, I'm not confrontational, I'm not, you know, bucking the system, I'm just, like, following what everybody else is doing. Every other white person is doing this. They're buying a home, they're having a family, they're going on vacations, they're, you know, they're not talking about politics, they're just, like, staying in their own lane. And, mm-hmm. and usually we talk about staying in your lane as a good thing, but, like, in this,
yeah,
this is like a shitty thing.
Yeah,
but you know what I mean. Like, I think we're losing so much, and we're also letting down. I feel like my ancestors are rolling around in their grave for me to, like, be here and not be recognizing the ways that colonization has fucked up my own ancestry, and then how colonization is continually fucking up Indigenous people's daily situations.
Yeah.
You know?
That's actually something that a really wise client of mine was saying, that for a lot of people who descend from a place where colonization had oppressed their ancestors,
yeah.
there's the opportunity now to fight that colonialism here where we are. And yes. we're not the direct targets of it here, but we have been. Our ancestors have been.
Yes.
And so it can be very healing, and healing of our whole ancestral line, to actually fight colonialism here.
Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant person.
Yes.
I think it goes back to the, like, why? Why should we do this work? I don't know. The more I know about myself, the more I know about where I come from, the more I know about my own history and my own lineages, and as much as I can find out. There's some people that don't have that privilege. Mm-hmm. That is a luxury for a lot of us. But the more I know about those things, in my mind, the more I can make good on the work that's already been done, the more I can, if the work has been bad work, change the work for the future. You know, like, I think there's something, and you got to want it, I guess, too. Like, you actually have to want to seek out information about your ancestry, even if it's, like, ugly, even if it's not favorable. Like, there's certain, I know my mom always tells me when the white people came to Kenya, we had our spears and we fought them off. Like, when I was a kid, she used to tell us, like, as little girls, that story. And yet, you know, like, Kenya for the longest time was called British East Africa. Mm. It was a British colony. Like, the ways in which British colonialism are so seeped into that country. Whew, oh, yeah. So fucked up. Oh, like, yeah. So fucked up.
Yeah, and I see the way, like, my dad, he was sent to a British-run boarding school. Like,
same with my mom.
Yeah, he was born, I think, the year of independence.
Okay.
Or the year after. Anyways, but he was sent to this British-run boarding school from the time he was 8. And he was telling me recently, they really instilled this absolute belief, you know, that white people are superior. And that he said it wasn't until he was in grad school that he even began to question that.
Wow.
Because it was so deeply ingrained in them.
Yeah. And my mom would tell me when she was growing up, like, she never read African literature. She was like, we didn't really get the opportunity to. We were just reading, like, Shakespeare and a bunch of other things. We always thought, like, the world was outside of, like, where you actually, where you lived. And then it's like you grow up and you end up seeing, like, all these African literary scholars, just, like, geniuses that, like, you know, white people are like, oh, I read this. You know, and it's like, damn, you missed out on so much because literally the white man came to your country and fucked shit up and continues to fuck shit up in your mind. And then I think it's fascinating too, so that's your dad's experience, my mom's experience, then, like, us being the legacies of them, how we decide to either, like, connect with our ancestry or don't connect with our ancestry, or seek it out, or be in community with people who are of our, like, ethnic group, racial group, I think is so... It's so intimately linked with, like, what we've been taught. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. Like, how much of your dad's questioning white superiority did he pass on to you, or did he not? I mean, you've mentioned that he wasn't involved so much in raising you. But, like, how valuable would have that been for him to learn that sooner and pass it on to you that, like, hey, listen, your brownness is, like, awesome and lovely and a beautiful thing to, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. And so I'm totally speculating about this. So maybe, I don't know if my dad, how much my dad is going to listen to these episodes and, like, call me and be like, what are you talking
about?
That's fair. But when I said earlier, you know, that we would try to ask questions and he was quite closed about India, I have wondered if part of the reason was that, you know, he was very heavily stigmatized. Like, you know, he's worked his whole career as a philosopher. So in very, very white institutions and very white departments, and very much surrounded by white people. And he said, you know, when he first moved to Canada, it was like people would scream Paki at you as you walked down the street. Like, it was like, you know, the racism was, like, much more in your face than it is now. And although
the resurgence a little bit.
But I guess it's kind of felt to me like there was this stigma that he sort of shut down around. And of course, now, you know, also putting together that it wasn't until he was even in grad school that he even began to question white superiority. And we know how long it takes to unlearn that shit. Like,
oh my God.
It's like a
decades.
Lifetime.
Yeah.
So I think that he didn't transmit more culture because he had internalized a lot of that stigma. And I think he also, you know, was raised at this British-run boarding school since he was 8 years old. I don't think he necessarily had the sort of skills as a parent to anticipate and to be able to instill that of, like, the world is going to tell you that you're less than, the world is going to tell you you're not beautiful, and you know, you are, and your culture is so important, and here's what it means to me, and here are these, you know.
Yeah.
So that would have made such a huge difference, but I don't think that he had that to give, and I imagine that given how brutal and long British colonialism in India is, I don't know how far you would have to go back to find ancestors who really held that pride and hadn't internalized that shame of being Indian. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I imagine that that shame has been carried for a long time in my family history.
Mm. And then, like, now as an adult, you doing your own decolonization work, like, you embracing your Indianness, you embracing your identity and who you are and what you look like and all these things that maybe, and you've done this work sooner than your dad did or had the privilege to do mm-hmm. when he was, you know, started doing that in grad school. How much do you think that for a lot of us who are just like embracing like the black is beautiful, the brown is beautiful, that kind of thing, we do that, but then we also don't turn around and look to like our indigenous siblings, our indigenous people around us, the people whose lands we literally have the privilege, if not like we've been reaping the benefits of, displacing them. Like, we don't look to them and say like, huh, I wonder how it feels to have your identity completely undermined in this, in the biggest sense, through like this lack of respecting indigenous sovereignty. I think it's kind of what I'm getting at is like, so much of our ancestry and our parents have worked through a lot of fuck shit. And here we are, we getting to sit beside each other, talk to each other, affirm our identities. And both of us try our hardest to like do our own work. But I know that we're not representative of necessarily everyone, and we're also imperfect. And how much of like a lot of people who look like me and you, so non-Indigenous people of color, are riding so hard for us to like embrace ourselves and like black is beautiful, but like also not seeing how we're perpetuating some fucked up shit for other people.
Yeah, because I think, you know, starting to question and spot and unlearn white supremacy is such a big task, and it's lifelong. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I even started until, I don't know, certainly like maybe late teenager.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very much ongoing work. So we're unlearning that, and then we're trying to connect more with our own cultures, you know, and learn more. I feel like I should also say, my dad apparently recently told my sister he was worried about how people, some young people now will like identify more as people of color than specifically their ethnicity, and worrying about the culture being lost. And then specifically said he thinks I identify more as a person of color than
Indian. Oh, really? And that's concerning to him. So
actually, I think I was wrong. Yeah, about the thing about ancestors being, you know, my living ancestor, my father is deeply concerned about it. But then my sister said, well, maybe you should have taught her more about the culture if you wanted her to. And he was like, oh, yeah, fair point. So that's been ongoing, right? Trying to learn about my own culture.
Yeah.
You know, and so that takes a long time. And then I think we can kind of, that's so much work that we don't always take the time to be like, well, actually, even though we spent our whole lives centering white people and we want to center people who specifically are like us personally.
Yeah, yeah.
That's only a small part of the work, because we actually need to be centering the people whose land we're on.
Yes.
Who we are, again, actively stealing from every day.
Yes. We're so busy just like getting like our, like, you know, I don't know, our jollies off, because we're like, we can see ourselves represented on screen. There's a movie about us.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and like, I don't want to poo-poo the wins.
No.
You know, I think the wins are important. I think the wins are valuable for us. But from like a bigger picture, it kind of reminds me of, you know, that there's a video clip of Toni Morrison speaking to this like white man asking her questions. And I have she's like, if you take race away and there you are, all strung out, all you've got is your little self. What is that? What are you without racism? Are you any good? Are you still strong? Are you still smart? And then she goes on to say, if you can only be tall when because somebody is on their knees, then you have a very serious problem.
Yeah.
And that, like, I don't know why, but that quote continued to percolate in my mind when I was thinking about this episode, because I think it's we're preoccupied as non-Indigenous people of color with our own collective community winning.
Mm-hmm.
But so often we do that as we turn a blind eye to the things that are happening on the land that we are benefiting from and are actively abusing, the people who are disenfranchised because of like, you know, our jollies, our representation, our the things that we've got. And it's, I know for a lot of us it might feel like we got to do like double work, But it's like, yeah, we actually do, though.
Yeah.
We do for people of good conscience. We do for people who want to, I think, honor our ancestors who have fought and died at the hands of colonization, at the hands of white supremacy. And we also do to our own parents who have, like, done what they've done to, like, give us this life, for us to have the privileges that we have, mm-hmm. and the voices that we have, mm-hmm. and the platforms that we have, and the money that we have, and the accolades that we have to, like, do some real work. And by do some real work, I mean, like, fuck some shit up.
Yeah, you and know? I totally. And I think it's like we always talk about things being both and. Yeah, right? It's yeah. like, yes, we want to fight for our own liberation. But also, I mean, as people who are targeted by white supremacy, who most of us, our ancestors, have been targeted by, specifically British colonialism for a lot of us, but, yes. you know, European colonialism
yeah.
more broadly, we aren't really doing the justice work that we need to do for ourselves and our ancestors anyway.
Yeah.
If we're not. So it's like, yes, it is like two different priorities
yeah.
that we need to balance. But at the same time, it's also not.
Mm.
It's also like we're doing a disservice even to ourselves and to our ancestors by not fighting against
Indigenous sovereignty.
Yeah, for Indigenous sovereignty yeah. against ongoing colonialism here.
Yes.
I'm reading A Mind Spread Out on the Ground by Alicia Elliott right now, which is amazing. And I just read this part where she's talking about her mixed heritage because mm-hmm. her mother is white and then her father's Haudenosaunee.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this essay about being mixed, and this really, I knew we were going to be doing this episode, and it really felt so resonant to me. So I'm going to read a passage from her essay. It is, "My white passing privilege gives me another, more complex responsibility. I have to use my white privilege like an undercover agent would use a good disguise, leveraging my lightness to drop the guard of non-Indigenous people around me, then slowly, methodically picking at their inherited colonialism, forcing them to reevaluate their own complicity in a way they may not have if they could easily identify me as Indigenous. More importantly, I need to lift up the voices of those in my community who, like my uncle, like my grandfather, like my father, are treated as less than human, unworthy of attention or time, because their skin is too dark for people's liking. I need to make sure that their experiences are centered, that their concerns are heard, that their needs are met. Being both Haudenosaunee and white wasn't a curse meant to tear me in two. It was a call to uphold the different responsibilities that came with each part of me."
Tell me about that quote. Tell me about what resonates with you with that. Because you went, Premel just went, wah!
Yeah.
You can't see her.
It was just so, yeah. I mean, I think I really resonated in so many different ways with that sort of that complexity and those different responsibilities because, you know, yes, I am a queer disabled woman of color. I have all my own oppressions and I need to radically fight for myself and yeah. center myself, yeah. you know, in things.
Okay.
And I'm a settler here. And the fact that I have all of those other parts of me that in no way diminishes my responsibility as a settler to the people that I actively harm,
mm-hmm.
you know, every day by being here. On stolen land,
yeah.
continuing to steal the resources that belong to somebody else. And also being mixed, you know, Indian and white, I think I've resonated with that too, because as much as I don't in any way pass for white, there's an intimacy there. Like I've, you know, I grew up yeah. in a white home.
Yeah.
I like grew up, I was raised with a lot of white people. And so I think I have like a window into it in a way. And I've sort of felt more of a responsibility to, I don't know, I guess, bring more people along to not just, you know, be angry and be like, fuck all of these people, but yeah. to sort of say, no, like, I need to find a way to, like, make people understand, you know, and bring people along.
You have, like, a sense of duty in a different way,
I
perhaps.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that I do. So I really appreciated that opportunity to reflect more deeply on how those different parts of my identity, again, like, they don't have to tear us apart. It doesn't have to be confusing that I'm a settler and I'm a person of color.
Yeah.
It can just be, like, these things work together. Like, again, I'm a person of color descending from, you know, people who were colonized.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that give me mm-hmm. that will allow me to fight better for Indigenous people, right, for Indigenous sovereignty, yep, to show up for Indigenous communities.
Mm, yeah. I really love that. Thank you for that quote. I'm glad you're reading that book.
Yes, it's amazing. So I have it in hard copy, so okay, I can give it to you.
Finally,
after.
I wasn't even going to ask if you. I'm like, she has it on an e-reader. Yes. This trifling lady. Never mind. I will borrow that afterwards. And this brings us to our last segment, which is People of Color of the Week that we love. And this week, I would love to highlight the work of Harsha Walia.
Oh,
oh yeah. Okay. You love her too.
Yeah.
So yeah, Harsha Walia, I think I started, like, I found out about her like maybe 7 or 8 years ago when I was an undergrad, which is a long time ago, it feels like. But I've always been enamored by her ability to, one, speak truth to power, two, just say things like they are, and never, ever, she never seems to waver in her dedication and her allegiance with Indigenous folks and Indigenous rights. I've always admired the voice that she is. And
she shows up.
She really does. And so if you don't know, now you know. Harsha Walia is a South Asian activist, writer, popular educator rooted in migrant justice, Indigenous solidarity, Palestinian liberation, anti-racist feminist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist movements and communities. She's been doing this work for a fucking long ass time. And most recently, which is like so bloody exciting, she was named the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. She's a really well-known activist in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, like, she's really known for her work with No One Is Illegal.
She co-founded No One Is Illegal, right?
Yes, yeah. Like, that's like her stuff. And she's been associated with, like, the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and the Women's Memorial March and many Indigenous land initiatives. The thing I love about her the most is that she always passes the mic. She always big ups everybody else's stuff. Her voice in and of itself is fucking phenomenal. She just blows me away. So one of the books that she has written called Undoing Border Imperialism, I just want to, like, read a little bit about it and then plug it and then say thank you, Harsha, because she's dope. So Undoing Border Imperialism combines academic discourse, lived experiences of displacement, and movement-based practices by reformulating immigrant rights movements with transnational analysis of capitalism, labor exploitation, settler colonialism, state building, and racialized empire. It provides the alternative conceptual frameworks of border imperialism and decolonization. Drawing on Harsha's experiences in No One Is Illegal, this work offers relevant insights for all social movement organizers on effective strategies to overcome the barriers and borders within movements in order to cultivate fierce, loving, sustainable communities of resistance striving towards liberation. So, like, if that doesn't compel you to buy her book, like, what will? Because Harsha is honestly a queen. And
another thing I love about her, I think it was something like her Facebook bio or something like that. It's so simple. It was like, tough on issues, soft on people.
I know.
And I'm like, words to live by, because I feel like that's everything, right? Like, have the best politics, but we need to be human to each other. We need to, especially when we're trying to show up in solidarity with another community.
Yes.
It's like, it's not for settlers to yell at other settlers and be like, you're horrible.
Snap,
it's for settlers to show up and say, hey, other settler, here's, you know, some
here's my
feedback.
Book.
Like, let's talk about this. Yes. Let's have a conversation. You know?
Absolutely. Yes, I know. That her bio, every single time I'd seen that, I was like, damn.
Yeah.
So, like, Harsha Walia.
Calling us to the work.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, Harsha, thank you so much for your work. We love you. We're in deep admiration of your work. And continue doing the work and the good fight. Chef's kiss. Hey, everyone. It's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community, and we cannot do this without you.